Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 2 of the Australian Light Horse. So the Australian Light Horse is sort of a legendary Australian military unit, and we're reading a slim volume. When I say it's a large format volume by Catherine Bell, and it sort of promulgates the Australian legend. But let's go that the sort of main point is that Australia was a world of horses, and there was sort of a legendary horseman. You know, people used to grow up riding horses, and horses were the main way of doing things in Australia pre-motor car. And there was, I suppose, various things, Sudan, forces, when Australia, before it was a country, was individual colonies. Individual colonies grew up. They had the hat, Borbrin hat, but that it was bent over at an angle so they could shoulder rifles on it. Sort of makes sense, so it has to be on the right-hand side, the slouch hat. And it got the emu feather from when they were mounted police rounding up the shearers' strike in 1891. So shearers shear sheep, and so they're critical in terms of the actual program that you have to, you can do everything, but you actually need a big bulk of this iterant labour and producing the wool. And there's a big shearers' strike in 1891. Sort of like a communist strike, so to speak. And the people who bashed the people up got a little emu feather. So this is a very sort of light feather that they could put in their hat, a feather in your hat. And so there was a lot of romance about it. They went and fought the Boers. The Boers is the Afrikaans word for farmer, the farmer's war. And the Afrikaans were Dutch, and they didn't like the English when they were given over to England in 1805. So I think that's something to do with the Napoleonic War somehow. I think it would be something to do with the Napoleon and stuff like that. So England took over the colony. Eventually, the Afrikaans did their great trek, their voortrekker, up to the Transvaal, and actually lobbed themselves on a gold mine and diamond mines, and the English decided they didn't like this. So in 1880 and then 1899, 16 years, so it must be 84, it must be 1884, around there they had the First Boer War, the Second Boer War, and then the actual location meant that it was set for the Australian Light Horse. The Australian Light Horse, or New South Wales Brigade, came along. And World War One came along, and those big people were just stupid, and they were going to go to England, but the training wasn't good enough for them, so they stopped in Egypt. And stopping there, they were just at the right time and place for the Turkish people to go across and try and cut off the Turkish canal. So it's sort of like the Turks were trying to get their canal, we were going to get the other canal, which is into the Bosphorus, across the Bosphorus and the Arman, big sea there, the Narrows going into it. Gallipoli was going to go there later, so we were there in 1814, 1815, so a year and a bit into the war, we did the Gallipoli landing, but the Light Horse wound up in Egypt, and were a very sort of mobile force, able to counteract the Turkish force, and there was a bit of a, you know, these Australians had opinions about the Bedouin and the Gibson's workers in general. They were really stuck up snobbers as far as I could see. And so we join this again. That's if I had to stop. What is it saying when I said goodbye to my wife going off to yoga, so I had to stop reading it. So this is a natural cause for being in the second period. And of course, my brain is to actually remember all this type of stuff, this general thing. So the Turks were stopped on one post, forced to go around the coast, and then began to take the coastal forts, and then 600 kilometres or 60 kilometres from the 16 kilometres from the Suez Canal, the Australians stopped them with the help of the Scottish Yeomanry. The issue here is the Australians didn't like them. How stop us over reading it. Okay, they're annoyed. Okay, now let's listen. This is Australian, you know, well, we are so good. I mean, of course, this is the last cavalry charge. Out on the battlefield, though, even the British officers were impressed with the riding prowess of the Aussies and their initiative and their mastery of skills of the mounted infantry. They were a formidable attack army and one always to be reckoned with by the enemy. On the whole, they thought that the Turks were clean fighters, which appreciated when dealing with the numbers of prisoners taken into various battles. The Australians were happy to share food and water with them and treat them with courtesy. This is a legend of, you know, the foe. The Turks also regarded them with respect and were appreciative of their daring and competence, despite being an opposite sides of the war. There was no real animosity between them, except engendered at the heart of battle when stress can allow emotions to run out of control. How stupid. The German commanders believed the Turks were undisciplined and unable to plan efficiently, and as a result of this sent their own officers to organise them, which caused resentment and sparked arguments. Not a happy situation in the middle of a war. Gallipoli. A plan to invade the Gallipoli Peninsula on Turkish soil was devised by the British Admiralty and supported by the first Sea Lord, Winston Churchill. If successful, it could open the way to Constantinople, now Istanbul, at the time of the capital of Turkey. It still is the capital of Turkey. And as a result of this plan, British and French would be able to link up with their ally Russia by controlling the Dardanelles. The Sea of Marmara and the Bosphorus, narrow opening to the Black Sea. This would mean free access to the Black Sea ports, which would ensure ships could pass through the waters without risk of attack. On paper, the plan seemed to be one that succeeded due to the insufficient knowledge of the terrain. Lack of efficient preparation, poor liaison between the various commanders, it was a disaster. Yeah, Australia was absolutely a disaster. From the get-go, from the first day, the 20th of April, 1915. So the war's been going for a year. There's about 2.5 years of war left after. The landing place, now named Danzig Soe, was fronted by steep cliffs covered by rough scrub, which made excellent cover for Turkish snipers hiding in the bushes. This made the task of scaling the cliffs almost impossible under the rain of bullets coming from the top of the cliffs. The troops coming ashore of the beach were easy targets as they tried to clear the water, and many died before they reached the base of the cliffs. It was wholesale slaughter with little or no gain. Well, it's not complete. I think 5,000 people died in the campaign, and 2.5 died in. 2.5 out of 50, you know, it's pretty bad. Okay. There was great acts of bravery that marked the campaign, but there was little excuse for the futility and the enormous loss of young men's lives. While the carnage was going on in Gallipoli, the light horse was still clamped in Egypt with their horses. But when the wounded were brought back from Gallipoli and told of the dreadful conditions they had to endure, the troopers volunteered to leave the horses and go at once to Gallipoli as infantry themselves. But just like the infantry, they suffered very heavy casualties. Oh dear, how stupid. This was particularly so at a place called the Neck, the narrowest strip of land on the high ground above the cliffs, which formed the link between the two eroded galleries. The Light Horse Volunteers remained in Gallipoli until the Anzac troops were withdrawn on the 8th of January 1916, and then returned to Egypt to be reunited with their horses. They trained recruits to fill the gaps made by the losses incurred at Gallipoli. the horsemen were probably disappointed at not being able to send to France, where they had heard the real war was being fought. I'm impatient at being stationed in the desert, while I thought that nothing would happen. But the Ottoman Empire wanted to capture control of the Suez Canal. An unsuccessful attempt had been made before the light horsemen left Gallipoli, and by the time they had returned, another attempt seemed likely. The Battle of Romani, 4th to the 5th of August 1916. The light horse and their mounts had written their names in the history books by their capacity and endurance and bravery. Well, gee, now we know that the light horse was actually at Gallipoli, the stupid people. A source of pride for all Australians and for generations to come. The British and Anzac mounted divisions under the command of Major General Hunter Chevelle were based in Egypt, but their priority was to prevent the Turks from establishing themselves in Romani, which is the centre of extensive system of oases. The water in these wells had been used since Egyptian invasions in the times of the pharaohs. It was a desolate place surrounded by huge sand dunes, but the presence of water and the fact that there was only 40 kilometres from the canal made defence from it from an invading army of Turks essential. The battle to hold Romani lasted two desperate days. The Turks were fanatical fighters and pushed the light horse brigades to the limits of endurance. The Australians had to defend and hold the town because it was their base, railway depot, and with a water pipeline being constructed towards the oases of Katia and Ograntia, a place of strategic importance, being close to the Suez Canal and the entry point into Egypt, it enhanced its importance. At the end of 3 days, the Turks moved back to Katia and the wells, but defeat was not final as the Australians would have liked it. It dispersed the enemy but left him able to regroup and attack again, which he did at Katia and Bir el Abid. Because they could not get much needed water, the light horse were forced to return to Romani under orders of Lieutenant General Chevelle, who was in command. But the Turks were in retreat and heading towards El Ashish, close to the Palestine border. At this time, Sir Archibald Murray, who was the British commander in chief, appointed Lieutenant Sir Charles de Bell, commander in chief of the Eastern Forces, to cover the Suez Canal and the Sinai. He, in turn, Lieutenant Sir Philip Chetwode, to command the Desert Column, which composed of the Anzac Mounted Division, the Imperial Mounted Division made up of the 3rd and 4th Australian Light Horse Brigade and the 5th and 6th Yeomanry. The Light Horse watched these changes of command with interest, but went on the task ahead, which was to march on El Ashish and push the Turks further north. On arrival, they found the enemy had left the town 2 days before, and it became clear the Turks were now definitely in retreat, and they thought they would make a stand at Bag Harbour and at Rafah. Their dreams of capturing the Suez Canal and Egypt had come to nothing. The light horse were happy to be in El Ash. The hardship of the Sinai and the hot winds, sandstorms and countless flies were over. The landscape of Palestine was in many ways similar to Australia, and the Biljims felt, that's the Aussies, felt much more at home with their horses, glad to have found ground under their feet instead of shifting sand as they travelled over for so long. Water in the desert. The provision of adequate water supply was absolutely vital factor in the desert warfare, and invading armies for thousands of years had acutely aware of this. Both sides were at risk, as without adequate water supplies, the desert spares no one from the horrible and lingering death from thirst. A man can survive only a litre of water a day if necessary, but horses require at least 22 litres a day to keep them in good condition. As time went on, horses were forced by the circumstances to survive longer periods in the desert oasis, where the wells were located, were furiously fought over by both sides. Sometimes the enemy would poison the wells, or quite often blow them up. This was perfectly valid action in war, of course, and deadly. We're going to be sad about the horses, aren't they? For those running out of water, it was a tactic frequently used by German officers who were advising the Turks on field operations and strategy. Water in some wells was brackish and tasted bitter because of the contamination of the roots and palm trees surrounding the oasis, and the wells also had been very thirsty before they would drink, but did not drink it. the need for water continued a constant concern for both the Turks and Allied forces during the entire desert campaign, especially while they were engaged in fighting their way across the Sinai. And in the summer of 1918, when the Light Horse was stationed in the arid Jordan Valley, and this was a place of unrelenting heat accompanied by hordes of mosquitoes, scorpions, spiders, poison snakes, and just as an added hazard, the Turkish army was always close at hand. Well, as the war progressed, improved technology in motor vehicles meant that they were able to carry more equipment. Tanks were introduced into the battlefront, but proved unreliable and were too primitive to cope with the harsh terrain, and very little was achieved by the deployment in desert conditions. The Light Horse was a reliable mount, continued to perfect the answer to desert warfare, and their service continued to further hone their skills, overcome the difficulty of the climate and landscape. This is embarrassing to read. Gaza. The next important task of the troopers, the Light Horse, was to capture of Gaza, which is a large town in Palestine near the Mediterranean Sea. It had been heavily fortified by the Turks, and hedges of prickly pear had been grown around the town to slow down any attempt of the invader to thrust their way through the perimeter. In spite of this, the troopers were able to hack their way through the prickly pear, shooting and being shot at through the cactus leaves and almost reaching the town centre. But to their maimers, the order came through from the officer in command to retreat. They were convinced that the Turks were ready to surrender, and from the reports that reached them, it was obvious that they were ready. Really was about to happen. The enemy was totally demoralised and had to lay down their arms. It seems the word had been received that a large Turkish relief force was approaching the town, and the commanders thought it would be futile to continue the battle. This proved to be incorrect, so General Dobell chose to deceive the War Office in London by informing that the attack was a success. I don't quite understand it. Oh, well, yeah. Another attack was vital, especially as the British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, wanted Jerusalem captured to give the British people good news at Christmas present to make up for the disasters happening in the Western Front in France. So Gaza had been taken. The second attack began on the 17th of April 1917. I don't quite understand this. And it was unlucky from the start. Everything went wrong in spite of massive artillery barrage and warships off the coast. The gas shells brought in could not function properly because the wind and the tanks were too slow. One exploded, taking a crew with it. So a better plan had been devised for a successful outcome. So Archibald Murray, who had been in overall command, had made several unfortunate blunders and was called. And General Sir Edmund Allenby, who had been serving in France, was brought in to take over the job. He was like a breath of fresh air to the troops, who were soon to call him Bull, the name he was known by in France. He brought new hope to the Middle Eastern campaign. With his optimism, his dislike of incompetence, his hatred of war, and his deep appreciation of the men who were so heavily involved in chasing the Turks from Palestine, he liked to meet as many of the troops as possible, and on his arrival at the camps was usually unannounced, and in this way he was able to judge how things were for himself without unwanted advice from others. My God. The troops grew accustomed to the whirlwind visits, and because of his interest in their welfare, their respect for him increased until he was regarded by them as somewhat, something like awe. How could anyone write this rubbish? I mean, it's true, it's all true, but, you know, the world's a bitch. I mean, the other aspect is that these people are not the TV generation, they're not mobile phone, they are uncritical people. Okay, desert warfare, the world's at Beersheba. The world's date back to the days of the Old Testament patriarch Abraham, who had bargained with the Philistines, the owners of the wells, for the use of the water they contain. The name Beersheba, translated in English, means the well of the oath. It is a place revered by the Arabs as well as the Jews, who both believe the biblical character Abraham is a remote ancestor of both the desert peoples through his sons Isaac and Ishmael. Beersheba. After the debacle of the two unsuccessful attacks on the fortress of Gaza, um, Oh, okay. So the Australians retreated. But to their amazement, the order came through from the officer in the command to retreat. They were convinced that the Turks had were ready to surrender from the reports that had reached them. It was obvious that they were ready. This already was about to happen. The enemy was totally demoralized, ready to lay down their arms. It seems that word had been received that a large... Oh, okay. So we gave up Gaza. Okay, so we bungled Gaza. Okay. Under the guidance of Major Richard Mietzenbergenhagen, an intelligence officer of General Allenby's staff, a plan was to deceive the enemy was taking shape. Mietzenbergenhagen was always questioned by outsiders regarding the origins of his name because people thought it was German. However, he was quick to tell them that it came from the Danish ancestry. As well as being an astute intelligence officer, he was also a keen bird watcher with a special interest in migratory habits of Middle Eastern birds. It had been considered by commanding generals that the attack on the desert town of Beersheba might be the backdoor method of capturing Gaza, but the ever-present water shortage has been one that seemed impossible to solve, although Beersheba itself possessed many reliable wells. There are other smaller water replacing scatterings through this arid area were used by the Nobat tribes to water their camels, but it was doubtful they would have adequate for the numbers of thirsty horses. However, it was imperative to capture Gaza and keep forcing the Turks to move north, so Major Mietzenbergenhagen was required to devise a plan of action. So the birds, he's interested in migratory birds. He rode out into the desert where the Turkish patrols regularly went, taking his documents containing seemingly important information on troop movements to Gaza, and a letter from his wife about family matters. This is untrue, but it gave the other papers authenticity, and hopefully the hoax would deceive the enemy. Meanwhile, at Gaza, preparations were going ahead for the proposed attack. Gunships were moving up the coast, more troops were being brought in, and air of expectation existed in the town, so the Turks responded by bringing in more of their troops. However, it seemed as if the ruse was working, even though the Turkish commander at Beersheba was not quite convinced. But the German advisers were quite definite that the information found in Major Mietzenbergenhagen dropped papers were authentic, so the Turkish commander was overruled. So why is he's important, but why is he a bird watcher? There's always been the view of the Turks that their allies, that the attack on Beersheba would be practically and impossible, for it was well defended on all sides except on the east, which had a natural protection of the desolate Negev Desert, an arid waterless place. It was from this direction that the Light Horse planned to attack. Some of the horses were watered in the wells at Kalsha and Ashini, and others went to Aslug, but it was found that the Turks had blown up the well there, so the horses could not drink. It was essential that Beersheba was captured in a single day, so the horses could be watered that night, otherwise some would die. On the 31st of October 1917, the troopers took up their positions in the south and moved on the eastern and desert side of the town in preparation of the attack. The Turks and Austrian gunners fought hard as the day moved on without the water getting closer. It was decided that officers in command, that a drastic action had to be taken. The Light Horse would have to make a cavalry attack and try to force the issue. This is not something they had done before. Their usual method was to attack was to ride to a point some distance away, dismount, have their horses move back by handlers, then proceed as infantry, and then again on ground as they would remount and do the same thing again. Accustomed to the usual Light Horse ploy, the Turks watched them and before firing their guns waited for them to dismount. But to their amazement, this did not happen. The horses kept galloping towards them at full speed, and very soon they were jumping over the trenches, and the Turks were unable to fire their machine guns since the horses were too close and they could not aim. The troops shouted and waved their bayonets around their heads, and the Turks were terrified, for they hated hand-to-hand combat. You can imagine that. I'd hate hand-to-hand combat with angry Australians. Okay, here's a big story. Aeroplanes in World War II. Fighting, and many of them quickly surrendered while others fled in sheer terror. The Biljims were desperate to find water for their horses. They had been thirsty for far too long, and they were suspicious the German officers would blow up the wells before either the men or the horses could drink. They were right to be suspicious, just as they suspected. The Germans had started to blow them up, but they had caught one officer in the act and was able to stop him before they finished the job. On and on they went, on and on, further and further at the breakneck speed. It was wild, wild rush, and the wells, the thirsty horses, nearly went mad as they smelt the water. On and on, further and further, and there they were. The troopers were too anxious to drink. Their water bottles were quite empty after a long ride and the anxious day of the Battle of the Hot Sun. In spite of two wells being destroyed and two damaged, there was still a reservoir of 40,000 litres of water there for taking. It was a satisfactory ending for this historic day. The Biljims had achieved a great victory, and both men and horses were able to drink their full fill of fresh water. The cavalry charge was a great act of bravery, and it was also the very last cavalry charge ever made in modern warfare. The battle honours earned by the late horse regiments are still proudly displayed in armoured units that have replaced them on special parade days. It's always thrilling to see the descent of the light horse troopers with their emu feathers in their hats astride the fine horses as their fathers and grandfathers did in the Middle Eastern desert so long ago. After the victory at Beersheba, the morale of the light horse troopers was high, so they were optimistic about the Battle of Gaza, which had to be taken so that Turks could be pushed further north and finally out of Palestine. It fell in early November 1917. After an easy victory, the Turks had practically abandoned the town in their rush to withdraw, although a shortage of water did slow the advance of the Allies. The enormous pressure put on Beersheba wells by the needs of men, horses and camels created a water problem, so the troopers' mounts were again forced to drink much less. But this was nothing new for those sturdy animals who had suffered much from the start of the campaign. Now at last, the way to Jerusalem was open, and General Allenby carefully laid down his plan to advance by studying the route of the Turks were taking in their retreat. These plans, so minutely detailed and discussed with his officers, had to be changed as things were not going well in France. The Germans were making a big push forward, and Allenby had been told to send extra troops to the Western Front to help deal with the problem. He did this reluctantly and then continued his examination of the position of the Turkish troops. He had split the army into two sections. One would follow the coast facing the pursuing Anzac Mounted Division as they fled. The other section moved towards the Judean hills near Jerusalem. The Australian Mounted Division followed them, but they were found the terrain very rough, which made it difficult for the horses to find their footing in the rocky surfaces. The weather too had changed for the worse. The autumn rains had started, and they climbed. They grew colder and colder. The troopers were not dressed for cold, wet weather, and there was no shelter for much of the time. They were soaked through. Increasingly, supply problems forced the horses to be sent away, except those belonging to the 10th Light Horse, who, with their horses, were to be part of the attack on Jerusalem. However, the Turkish army was leaving the city, probably because it was a holy place for Jews, Christians and Muslims, and it was feared that sacred sites would be damaged by gunfire. The 10th Light Horse Regiment then rode into the city to be welcomed by the citizens, although they were unsure of what had happened was happening in their own future. The light horse troopers were housed in the Turkish cavalry barracks, which offered them more comfort than the freezing bleak hillside and the perimeter of the city. Many of the light horse were given a break on the coast at the place called Balar to recover the hardships they had endured. But the Anzac Mounted Division were at that time on their way to take the ancient city of Jericho, which is situated in the Jordan Valley. Perhaps the route they took was the same as the one taken by the Good Samaritan who travelled from Jerusalem to Jericho, as told in the Old Testament story. The Jordan River was in full flood, so the bridge had to be built, enabling the troops to cross, but the Turks were well entrenched on the far bank, firing at them across the river and making construction very difficult. At last, the platoon bridge was built, and some of the troops walked across, forcing the Turks to move to the foothills of Moab Tableland, which General Allenby turned to take. objective was to capture Amman, the present capital of the Arab state of Jordan, and the mountain town of El Esselt, north of the climb was very cold and it was raining hard, and the horses and camel found it difficult to manage the steep slopes, but they finally reached the top of the Moab plateau at 1,200 meters above the valley. The weather improved and they were able to rest, but not for long. The Turks and the German Asia Corps were waiting for them, for the Battle of Amman was fierce. It was expected that Colonel T.E. Lawrence, known as Lawrence of the Arabia, and the Arabs had trained, would join the assault, but they did not come. Are you wasting people? So Lawrence of Arabia was just a joke. There you go. Battles of Amman and El Salt were not progressing favourably for the British and the Light Horse Division, who were fighting desperately on the rocky hillsides outside the town, trying to force the defenders to surrender. At first, it seemed hopeful, but later the Turkish infantry appeared to be forced by the German Uderman Stormer troopers, who were formidable opponents. 6,000 Germans and a line of German-trained Turkish infantry appearing parade-ground style in open ground was an alarming sight for the beleaguered allies. They were forced to withdraw from Amman and El Salt in spite of valiant efforts to keep the mountain tracks open. The weight of enemy numbers proved too much, and they scrambled over the rough places, hoping that their horses would not lose their footing. Lose their footing on the rocky terrain. At El Salt, terrified Christian refugees begged to be helped to escape. Time after time, the light horse riders... Oh, God. Assisted refugees down the track, carrying the women and children on their sturdy whalers to comparative safety. The weary troopers moved back across the Jordan, glad to rest, eat, drink, and attend their faithful horses who carried them so bravely. The time had come to count the cost of the operation, which in the eyes of the light horse was high. They had lost 50 troopers, 278 wounded, and 37 missing. The weather was warming up, and the light horse brigades were forced to spend the summer in the inferno of the Jordan Valley, which was something like even the Bedouin would not do. The Belgians had the dubious honour of being the first Europeans to survive. They had learned ways of overcoming heat in the furnace of the Sinai and Rumina days, but they had no answer to the hordes of malarial mosquitoes that attacked them viciously, causing serious illness and death of many. While they were trying to overcome the natural hazards, the Germans and Turks attacked, and a furious battle broke out, making things look very grave. The Germans fought as if possessed, and many light horse troopers were killed. But the 1st Regiment stepped in. The enemy was overcome. Many of the Germans were taken prisoner, but they were thankful to retreat with dignity and would possibly believe that the war was over for them. Meanwhile, things were happening in Jordan Valley in preparation of Albury's great ride up the coast of Palestine, which would take him and the light horse to the ancient city of Damascus in Syria. Elaborate precautions had been taken to let the Turks believe that the attack on Damascus would come on inland route. Groups of soldiers marched to the valley in daylight and were driven out during the night to reappear again in the morning. Dummy horses stood in line, seemingly preparing for an attack. With these deceptions, the Turks were fooled. The British and the light horse swept up the coast, pushing the Turks further north. Colonel Lawrence and his group of Arabs were at hand to assist in destroying railway lines and generally harassing the retreating enemy. Damascus was attacked and captured after a furious battle, but the Turks were driven to retreat, leaving rioting and looting behind them, which was put down by mounted troops, including the light horse troopers. Unfortunately, disease broke out amongst the Belgians and was the cause of many deaths. Even though the success of the Middle Eastern campaign was marred by illness, the war of the light horse troops was over. They had acquitted themselves with great distinction and had earned the admiration of both. Oh, they were just beaten the arse of them by the Germans, weren't they? They acquitted themselves with great distinction and earned admiration of both friend and enemy with their fairness and braveness in battle. The great sadness for them was having to leave their beloved horses behind to comply with the strict quarantine laws of Australia, which made it impossible for them to return. So they shot their horses eventually, you know, behind them, be eaten. The army first decided that they would be sold to the Egyptian spies, but the troopers were incensed at this, for they hated the way they treated the animals, and the orders changed. Some were taken by Indian regiments, and others were shot by the troopers rather than have them fall into the wrong hands. Light horse riders, they go shoot you. You have to shoot. You shoot the pony and shoot the husky. You got to kill a husky. The light horse riders were then free to return home to the families. An armistice had been signed by the British on the 31st of October 1918, to be followed by the armistice on the Western Front. On the 11th of November, the young men who had set out to seek adventure and see the world were still young in age, but very old in experience. They remember all their lives the days of discomfort and fear and excitement of the deserts of Palestine. The Light Horse was disbanded in 1940 during the Second World War. There was no place for horses in this new mechanized war technology that had taken over the battlefield. That's page 31, and we're coming to the end. So here's the timeline. 1652, the first Europeans arrived in South Africa from Holland to establish the colony of Table Bay on the southern tip of South Africa. 1803, Cape Colony is ceded to Britain. 1880, the First Boer War breaks out, but it's over in a few months and peace for 19 years. 1899, the break of the Second Boer War and recruitment of young men to be in South Africa. 1902, the war ends and Bushmen return to the new nation. 1914, the outbreak of the First World War, and the Light Horse are recruited to go to France, but Turkey declares war on the Allies, and the Light Horse remain in Egypt to protect the Suez Canal. 1915, the Gallipoli Plan, and some Light Horse volunteer as infantry. 1916, Turkey attacked the Suez Canal, and the Battle of Romani, Turks defeated, retreating north of the Light Horse pursuit. 1917, the advance of the Light Horse continued to Beersheba, Gesheba, and Jerusalem are captured. 1918, Amman, El Salt, Damascus captured. Armistice signed between the British and the Turks. On the 31st of October, the Light Horse troopers return home. In 1914, the Light Horse units become mechanized. So that's the story of the Light Horse. I hope you enjoy it. I hope that's been recording during that time. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.